the arrow came from. Derek, fire in that direction! Fire at once! Will you stop shouting? I'm writing a message to Soros. He'll send some more boys over at once. That didn't sound good. These five players, or maybe there were more of them, seemed to have company. They may have been the patrol group of a strong party keeping track of all the approach to the disposition of the main force, or a bunch of scouts. Therefore, there were other players nearby, and there was probably a lot more of them. The mysterious archer was just a single person, no matter how skilled. It was unlikely there would be two or three masters of disguise of this level around. Therefore, the archer wouldn't be able to take on a large group. Unless they were one of those legendary Asian players, that is. The popular opinion was that they never ate or slept, and had been leveling up since the very launch of the project. Their levels were so high, they should soon be capable of competing with top-ranking guards from the Imperial Army. But what would such a high-level player do in a backwater like this? Guys, does anyone have any salve for fractures? I could really do with some. My legs can barely function. Why don't you shut up? You'll let them know where we are. Thud. Arrgh! That's what you get for shouting, you moron. Now you don't need any salve at all. Ross hid behind the bushes, pretending to be a pile of yesteryear's leaves or something even less appetizing, but he kept an eye out to observe the environs all the same. The rain had stopped. There were just the droplets falling from the leaves, so nothing was getting in the way of the Rock's night vision. It turned out to be a really useful skill, and it had seemed perfectly useless to him initially. He was some noob for sure, failing to realize just how lucky he was. It wasn't that he had gone that far since then, though. And what was that sound? Did a branch crack under someone's foot, or did he just imagine it? Oh no, he didn't. A branch moved, sending forth a spray of water droplets. A hand emerged, only to disappear and reappear in another opening in the bushes. The owner of the limb came out in all his glory, shortly afterwards, a tall, thin man with incongruous triangular ears and a pointed hood. He had a fancy-looking bow in his hand, with an arrow drawn, with tiny multicolor sparks falling in every direction. He obviously belonged to one of the elvish races, and there were lots of those. Most of them favored bows. Could he be the invisible archer? If Ross was right, the pointy-eared players weren't all that adept at disguising themselves. Also, he would never have spotted someone that good. He'd have been spotted first, and much earlier. This one didn't even throw a casual glance at the hiding noob, as though completely unaware of his presence. Another player appeared behind the archer, in a chainmail shirt and a full helmet with a shield and a battle hammer. Such characters tend to be noisy, and would never be a natural choice for a fighter who preferred to stay unseen. Therefore, Ross was seeing the remnants of the very group that got him hiding at the edge of the charred woodland. They all looked worried and hurried, and kept looking about them. There were lots of noises in the forest after the rain. There were drops falling from the leaves, and the branches that had soaked up water would fall with a loud crack every now and then. Both players would startle in a most comical manner each time they would hear such a sound. Their names were displayed in reddish lettering. They may not have been the worst kind of killers, but they must have killed someone who could not provide resistance relatively recently. And these guys looked pretty scared. Well, they deserved it. They wanted to shoot themselves a noob without too much trouble, but things have turned out differently. Thud! The warrior fell down with an unpleasant hoarse sound. His neck was pierced by an arrow that must have come from somewhere behind him. The wound to such a vulnerable place must have caused a brief shock. This state may last for a second, or three, or even 10. No one can tell for sure, but the victim will be utterly helpless all this time. Or it might have been something else. The arrow could have been enchanted with a stun spell. The result was the same, at any rate. Had the warrior remained standing, he could have turned around and used his shield. Those players were hardly the most pleasant kind of an opponent for an archer, and both classes could get on each other's nerves. One had excellent protection, but could not deal any damage from a distance, while the other could, but their protection sucked. Archers were similar to mages in this respect. The only way in which they were superior was their high agility, which meant a higher chance of dodging an attack. Thud, thud. The warrior didn't so much as cry out. He fell down with two arrows in his back and another in his neck. He looked like a porcupine with most of its quills plucked out now. He'd either be dead or in so deep a shock that it would take him a long time to recover. High-level archers who knew what they were doing could be regarded as pure evil. The elf took a pot shot and then started running without paying any attention to the road, just like Ross did recently. He chose a direction that was most unfortunate for Ross. It was obvious that he would run anywhere his feet would take him to escape deadly arrows from the dark, but it was extremely annoying that he chose the very direction where Ross had been hiding. In real world, he could have passed within 2 feet of Ross and failed to notice him in the darkness and the bushes. However, the game had laws of its own, and there was a range at which a player would discover you no matter how good your disguise. It depended on one's disguise and perception skills, as well as class and race bonuses, and, to a lesser extent, a couple of other stats. The range itself could vary from a few dozen feet to mere inches. In Ross's case, those few inches weren't an option. He was a pathetic noob in comparison to a player of that level. The elf would doubtlessly grab his bow as soon as he'd found out there was someone in the way, and at such a distance, it would be stupid to hope for him to miss. A single arrow would do for a noobster. He couldn't run away, but he couldn't stay either. What options did that leave him? To fight? That would be ridiculous. Given the difference in their levels, only Ross's chaos skills would reach the opponent, and those wouldn't do much damage. The chaos school was great as far as debuffs were concerned, since the most important thing about those was the likelihood that a given spell will work. However, in terms of actual damage, even high-level skills were inferior to those of any other school of magic. However, other spells would most likely get dispelled or hit the opponent for a single token point, so it made no sense to use any of them in this situation. Debuffs had a whole range of interesting features he could rely on right now, though, namely, control skills. Those had little to do with damage. Their main function was to make the opponent unable to attack, or at the very least, to make them immobile and thus incapable of running toward you. There were even specialist mages and warriors whose function was to keep the target motionless so that it wouldn't enter combat. Such players hardly dealt any damage by themselves. They merely helped others to win with impunity. Ross wasn't one of those. His main control skill was sleep. It could be used to turn a player into a living statue of sorts. They could see and hear everything without being able to move so much as a finger. Once he dealt any damage to the opponent at all, the effect would be dispelled. Alternatively, it would wear off once the time specified by the game's mechanics would elapse. Unfortunately, sleep, too, may fail to work. Ross often had it happen to him when he fought high-level monsters. It was all a matter of luck. Still, he was lucky, and his actual luck stat was so high that not even the beefed-up Asian Superman players had anything on him. What would be the point of casting a spell that would only hold his opponent immobile for a couple of measly seconds? The cooldown time for it was long, and he wouldn't get a chance to use it again. The effect would wear off, and the elf would dispatch the impertinent noob furiously. He wouldn't manage to run away in such a short time, and there was no shelter anywhere. The edge of this wood was one of the worst places to hide. On the other hand, the invisible archer hiding in the thicket would get an excellent chance to get the last high-level target without sweating much. They might be grateful enough to Ross for this gesture of goodwill to forego wasting him along with the others. It gave him a glimmer of a chance to survive a rather sticky situation. Ross waved the short staff that he had crafted himself with the aid of the recently received transmogrification cube, a miraculous artifact that had once belonged to the Craftsman Guild Master from the Locked Lands. He made a number of attempts, some more successful than others, but this staff was his favorite, and it gave an extra chance of casting a successful spell or dealing magical damage. It was really useful if the target had a high resistance to your spells, which is usually the case when the level gap is too great. There was less of a chance to miss. The elf froze, as though thunderstruck. Now he could see Ross perfectly well, but there was nothing he could do anymore. The spell worked, and the target wasn't merely immobilized. It could not take any actions whatsoever. Ross just hoped no heavy branch would fall on his opponent's head. A single point of damage, and the bastard would unfreeze. So what would happen next? Where was the invisible master archer? His favorite dish was served and could be had at any moment. A second. 2 seconds. 3. Nothing was happening. Thud. The elf gave a shrill cry as his right hand got nailed to the nearest tree. He made a desperate effort to free himself, but it wasn't enough, so he stayed a still target right where he had stood. Ross looked the archer in his eyes, half mad with pain and fear, and chuckled sarcastically. Then he said, copying his earlier mocking intonation, "You should never try to dodge an archer, or you'll be real tired by the time you're killed." The second arrow that came from the woods nailed the elf's head to the tree. So much for him. Ross sighed, turned around very slowly, and peered into the darkness. Even his vision didn't allow him to see much in the murk under the canopy. Everything was covered in a mist after the rain, and soggy pieces of rotten wood glowed here and there like the blue eyes of monsters. He couldn't make out the invisible archer, but he knew he or she was out there. They might already have strung their bow, thinking of whether to hit him in the right eye or the left. The invisible archer was a crack shot, without a doubt. One of the rotten wood lights flickered, then another, then a third. Someone was walking through the forest, and the faint illumination provided by the phosphorescence got obscured for a moment every now and then. And this someone was approaching Ross. The shadows under the sprawling canopy got darker, and something changed in the way they fit together. At that very moment, the edge of a bright moon appeared from a gap in the clouds, as if doing so on request, and the moonlight illuminated a small silhouette of a woman holding a short bow in her left hand. She still looked like a blob of darkness come alive, even in moonlight. Only the incongruous lettering over her head testified to the fact that she was a player just like Ross. A few more steps, and he could finally see the archer in detail. The girl was petite, with short-cropped dark hair and clad in a baggy black outfit. There wasn't so much as a hint of any armor. Her face looked detached, and she had a thousand-yard stare one would hardly expect from someone who had just dispatched 5 high-level opponents at a canter. "Hello there, Bubble," said the girl in a calm voice that sounded void of all emotion.
"Hello, Thirinawaria Reneilla," replied Ross, and then asked, "You didn't come up with that name on your own, did you?"
"I didn't."
"Well, it shows."
"You can just call me Theory. We're likely to spend a lot of time together, so I wouldn't want to saddle you with a tongue twister like that."
"What do you mean, a lot of time together?"
"Well,
You're going somewhere, aren't you? I'm coming along. I've been waiting for you for a while. They told me you still had a long way to go, and you'll need help on your way, and someone to look after you. So let's get going.
Hey, hold on a moment. Who are you, anyway?
My name is written right over my head, and you can see it perfectly well. Ross could indeed see the ridiculous two-part name, as well as a couple of icons indicating other features of the character. The appearance was made up, not a copy of the owner's actual physique. The sex was female. There was nothing there to answer his question. Then he remembered Macho Strongman and Nail in the Head. Their names were less convoluted, but they also behaved strangely and demonstrated a strange willingness to accompany Ross anywhere.
Theory, can you tell me about your stats? How did you distribute them? Is your character normal or botched?
What a strange thing to ask. I wouldn't have asked without a good reason. We can talk about it on our way. Let's get going already. It's dangerous to stay here.
Cody Mitchell was sweating like a pig, the evening chill notwithstanding. This was hardly the best place to meet. There were too many drug addicts around, and they would do anything to get the money for the next fix. Cheap motels, lots of homeless people, and all kinds of weirdos galore. A respectable analyst from a multinational corporation had no business here. However, the journalist he had run into seemed to think that the Bayview was the best place for such trysts. Cody rued the day they'd first met, and it was all that noob's fault, the one who became a second-world celebrity out of the blue, curse him. As soon as the analyst managed to find an important lead, he was called by the top of the corporate brass, and he managed to impress them with his report. However, such impressions are soon forgotten if you do nothing to make sure the effect lasts. So Cody spared no effort trying to find out something else. He would sometimes manage to sniff out something overlooked by everybody else, but nothing was as important as what he had found out before, that very first time. He'd reckoned he would get a substantial raise, and even started thinking of moving into a better neighborhood. In that case, Helen would probably move in with him, or rather, he'd finally be able to propose. Anyway, if she kept nagging him about insufficient attention, he wouldn't have to move anywhere. His small apartment had as much space as he'd ever need on his own. Why was it so hard for her to understand his job was important? It was perfectly natural for him to do work-related stuff 7 days a week, IRL, as well as online. He was hunting for information. Anywhere he could get access to, and quite a few places he couldn't. He searched for it where no one else had thought of searching. He was prepared to make contacts that were frowned upon or outright forbidden. This journalist knew a few things, that much was true. However, they were, for the most part, things Cody cared little about at the moment. Apart from that, he was never particularly eager to share his knowledge, but always did everything he could to pump Cody for everything he knew. And Cody still had to bear the brunt of it. He was bound to share, at any rate. This reporter never let go once he got his teeth into something. Right now, he would have to share classified information that no one outside of his department should have had any access to. But it was worth it. Cody managed to get a really good lead. If what he'd managed to find out was true, now he knew how to find the elusive Mr. Rostovtsev without any trouble whatsoever. That was a real triumph. He wouldn't just get a promotion once he succeeded. It would open new horizons. The only thing was, how come this pencil pusher managed to find out something like that? What were his sources? Who could be giving him information of this sort? Or rather, where would one find such information in the first place? Cody might have to find the answer to this question sooner or later. Right now, though, it was unimportant.
even if the journalist got his info from green-skinned Martians with flute-shaped noses. His only concern was whether it were actually true. He also wondered about the number of people in the know. What would happen if some data dam broke and the information suddenly became available to everyone? Cody should hurry in this case. He had no intention of sharing his triumph with anyone. An unremarkable man, whose ID card said his name was John Shelby, watched Cody Mitchell's car go by dispassionately. The analyst who'd managed to get out of his depth was no concern of his. Another group was watching him, and they wouldn't let him go. He was an easy target. John was concerned about the journalist, and he wasn't going to let him get away either. Killing a journalist would be a pain in the ass, but it didn't mean those scribblers were invulnerable. If the powers that be decide to dispose of one of them, it would require a divine intervention for the journalist in question to live to a ripe old age. And John was certain that the Almighty God would not intervene on behalf of this fancier of black and Asian boys. He hated all sodomites, after all, so he probably never even looked toward this accursed city. God may even have plans to make it share the lot of Sodom and Gomorrah. No other city in this country deserved to be punished by the Almighty more than this one. The notorious journalist was so obsessed with his latest puffy-lipped boyfriend that he even chose this hellhole for a rendezvous, stinking with piss and crack smoke, over one of the cozier streets of his beloved Castro. The Bayview was dangerous. Even cops aren't safe here. The local gangs recognize no authority. But the journalist wouldn't get his hands into any young boy's pants tonight. Instead, he'd be lying on a dog-shit-covered flowerbed, fertilizing the earth with the blood coming out of multiple stab wounds. The cops would arrive at some point and bustle around, trying to look important, asking stupid questions, and watching CCTV recordings. The victim of street crime would be taken elsewhere and placed on the coroner's table. The cops will shortly prove that the moment of murder was never recorded by any CCTV camera, thus saving the city's money. The only video recording was of someone wearing conspicuous clothes walking away. Once they checked his movements from one camera to another, they would find out that the man entered one of the numerous apartment blocks and never came out again. The cops wouldn't stop there, of course. They would find the culprit's apartment, break down the door, and find the owner. But they wouldn't be able to question him for the simple reason that the owner would already be dead from overdosing on a new designer drug by that point. Those who got addicted to that stuff never lived long, so it wouldn't strike anyone as a surprise. When addicts felt they were about to crash, they would do anything for a small bag of stinky powder. So this one must have done exactly that. He took his knife, walked around the neighborhood, and found a chubby, doe-eyed fop at the corner. The guy was well-dressed and wearing an expensive watch, and he looked like he'd be more likely to cry like a baby than try to fight back. In other words, a most likely mark. The deceased addict obviously had nothing to do with the murder. CCTV cameras had low resolution, so it didn't even take the makeup artist that much effort to mask one of their men as one of the residents of this cesspit. The main thing was the clothes. The face also had to stay in the shadows. Not a single cop would find anything wrong. That kind of thing happened regularly in this neighborhood. A druggie left his filthy den and sliced up yet another fancier of urban boys. All kinds of pervs came there to get their kicks, after all. The killer took the watch and the wallet and went back home. He didn't even have to leave the block to get another fix. You could get it anywhere in the projects. And when addicts felt they were about to crash, they were likely to do stupid things, such as taking as high a dose as they could, and ending up stone cold in their chemical nirvana. Thus, the orders were carried out. Chapter 4 Theory was nothing like Macho Strongman or Nail in the Head, and it wasn't just the matter of her being a petite, brown-skinned girl, while those were huge guys with blonde hair. It wasn't just the matter of behavior. Those two laughed as jackasses, whether or not there was a reason to, kept looking for something to munch on all the time, had poor manners and even poorer vocabularies, nor were they any good in battle. In fact, they looked like total chumps when they fought. On the other hand, the sheer number of coincidences left him without a doubt that all three were involved in something that Ross had no inkling of. The very fact that they sought to accompany him placed them all in a single category.
"Hey, Bubble, why don't we rest for a moment?"
Another coincidence. Neither Macho Strongman nor Nail in the Head got weary this quickly. As for Theory, she couldn't climb a hill without having to sit down at least once. He might have been exaggerating, but the fact was that she'd had serious issues with her stamina, as well as a few other things. He was certain that the reason for it was the very same, unnatural stat point distribution. However, if Macho Strongman and Nail in the Head distributed their stats according to their current fancies, Theory was completely different. She deliberately made her character a cripple. Ross could not study her stats, but he harbored a strong suspicion that she invested everything into agility and accuracy, completely ignoring everything else. He had a good reason for such a conclusion. There was the matter of her race and class, first of all. Ross took every opportunity to study the game forum and soak up as much knowledge of the complex game world as he could, so he knew what Theory's choice had been. She was a Highlander assassin, an unpopular race, and a little-known class. It was simply too highly specialized. Nearly all the bonuses were related to disguise. Few could rival them in that respect, that much was true. However, it made no sense to stay invisible forever. One would have to show oneself, sooner or later, and that was where the race's numerous shortcomings came into play. First and foremost, their accuracy skill was negligible. Thus, a representative of this race would get less from investing a point into this stat than a player of a different race and belonging to a different class. Their strength was even worse. Its effect on the damage dealt was so paltry that it made no sense to use enchanted items or stat points to raise it. It made a lot more sense to choose objects with bonuses to actual attack and damage values. Defense was just as bad as accuracy. Even if you wrapped up a Highlander assassin in tank armor, it would do them no good. They were the first to be sent to their respawn points. They couldn't take any damage at all. All the other primary stats were in the medium range, with the exception of resilience. This is where Highlander assassins truly shone. As for secondary stats, disguise, perception, speed, and luck were pretty decent. The rest were nothing to write home about, but there were no serious handicaps either. Magical talents were also non-existent, so there were no hopes for a career as a mage. Nor would an assassin make a good worker. They had no bonuses conducive to honest toil, and lots of traits that made it near impossible. The resulting character would thus be unable to work, and a poor fighter to boot. They had no magical attacks, and their long-distance physical attacks did not deal enough damage, since accuracy plays a decisive role in such cases. Highlander assassins are never accurate enough. How could one use those poor things in battle? Were they doomed to see others fight and feel jealous all the time? Actually, such characters did have their niche, but it was highly specialized. One should remember their only strong suit, the ability to stay unseen. An assassin can steal through the ranks of the enemy in order to reach those at the back of the party. Those were usually healers and buffers. Everybody else took care of supporting characters, and they were hard to reach. However, should anyone manage to get to them, it would be a fox in the chicken coop scenario through and through. Those characters are usually incapable of defending themselves and die quickly. However, the window of opportunity wasn't that wide inasmuch as Highlander assassins were concerned. They couldn't deal much damage, and their strength was never high enough to matter. Nor could they use heavy weapons that would kill a healer in two blows. Thus, they had to opt for the shortest blades that were too light, too thin, and near useless against armored warriors, knives or daggers. However, supporting mages wore no armor, so that would do, and even though they didn't deal heavy damage, their weapons were fast, especially when they used two blades at once. They could approach from behind, activate short-term class skills, amplifying attack damage and speed, and make mincemeat of their target with a series of quick slashes. This would be a close-quarter fight, so no accuracy was really necessary, so all you could do was slash again and again. Your chances of getting to another target were really slim. One couldn't become invisible instantaneously. There are many nuances affecting the cooldown time of Highlander assassins' abilities, and most of them were negative. Therefore, they were suicide commandos. Just like the historical assassins led by Hassan-i-Sabah. The standard battle model was thus as follows. You sneaked up on someone, you killed them, and you got killed in turn. Obviously enough, few people would choose to fight such short and dramatic battles. It would be hard to become a famed warrior if one exchanged a life for that of a single enemy in the game. Highlander assassins were usually chosen by loners who were fond of hunting other players. Those were the very PKs with red names who relished in killing the weak and the stranded. They loved nothing like popping out from out of nowhere behind a noob's back and dispatching their victim with a few stabs of the dagger. But they could run into serious problems with properly defended players, even if those were of a lower level. It would take time to dispatch them, and time is never on a Highlander assassin's side. Receiving damage was a total no-no. A Highlander assassin was a ragdoll character for the most part, a pathetic noob slayer only able to get close because of invisibility. Theory's name was written in letters of pristine white, but nonetheless, that was the very character she had chosen. And Ross witnessed how she dispatched five high-level players without even breaking a sweat. Her level was 197. The ones Ross managed to examine had also leveled around 200. No one would ever believe that a half-naked Highlander assassin could kill five players in as many minutes with complete impunity. Theory managed to break the mold. She dispensed with the knives and the daggers altogether. At the very least, she didn't use them in this battle. What she did use was a bow, a weapon that's supposed to be completely useless for a character of her kind. Why useless? First and foremost, bows required accuracy. You had to be fast and hit a target from a distance. If your arrows missed, you were ridiculous, pathetic, and a danger to no one. Yet Theory didn't miss once during the battle. How could something like that be possible? And yet it could. He thought back to Macho Strongman and Nail in the Head. Both spent their primary stat points wantonly, spreading them around the way they wanted as their levels grew. A run-of-the-mill assassin would normally dump everything into strength and attack in order to maximize the puny damage they did. And yet Theory followed a different path, without making the same mistakes as the two lummoxes that Ross had left behind. She may have invested something into attack, the way such characters were supposed to, but she must have spent most of her points on accuracy, a stat no self-respecting assassin ever chooses to develop. Why would they? They worked at close quarters exclusively, after all. Her second best developed stat must have been agility, which had a positive effect on disguise and marksmanship. The third one may have been attack, but he wouldn't bet on it. Theory could develop nothing else. She simply lacked the capacity. Accuracy required a lot of investments, and without it, the bow in her hands would simply be a useless piece of wood. Why hasn't any other assassin tried to do the same as her? After all, the idea of leveling up a maverick character was more or less out in the open. The singularly effective disguise skills could help a player get close enough to their target to shoot them and have a decent chance of remaining unnoticed. The closer the attacker got to a target, the less likely would their disguise stay intact. In the traditional scenario involving knives and daggers, one lost one's invisibility at once. Ranged attacks were different, more complicated, yet more interesting. Theory managed to find the optimal stat distribution ratio bolstered by tactics and the equipment she used. She managed to strike without getting hit in return. And she was good at it. Why did no other players choose the same path? Well, the reason might be that the path in question was rife with pitfalls. One had so little strength that one couldn't afford to wear the lightest kind of armor. Thus, one would have to wear woven clothing and become a rag doll. However, if mages, who were the first to earn that derogatory title, got decent bonuses from such clothes, an assassin couldn't hope for anything of the sort. Moreover, such clothes would actually be to one's detriment, since they would lower one's defense, already paltry, even further. One wouldn't be able to join the ranks of regular archers in battle, for instance. One would lose all of one's HP in situations where they wouldn't even notice the attack. One wouldn't manage to hit faraway targets either, due to the same deficiency of strength. That was also why one couldn't use heavy bows that could deal major damage. One would be so weak that even walking down a path following a flat terrain would tire one quickly. A gust of wind could sweep such a player off their feet. High resistance to magic, particularly control and spotting spells, wasn't much solace. The saddest thing was that one could drive one's target into fits, but still prove incapable of dispatching it. One's bow would be too weak, the arrows would be too light, and a single shot wouldn't do much damage. You'd have to make a hedgehog of your enemy, and every shot would put you in danger of being spotted. Killing a target in a shot or two, the way all the other archers did, wasn't an option. How on earth did Theory manage it? It wasn't that hard. She aimed for the most vulnerable spots, and most likely used everything she could to raise the chance of a critical hit. And even a weak critical hit can deal extreme damage. Deep wounds made by arrows were ideal for that. The problem, though, was that hitting the opponent anywhere wouldn't do the trick. One had to aim for really tiny areas. An inch to the side would mean a mere flesh wound. How could one accomplish something like that? As far as the bow was concerned, skill mattered most. It might sound banal, but the player should be in perfect control of their weapon. This is why many professional athletes with a solid background in archery IRL became successful as players of this class. Therefore, this wasn't a choice for everyone. If one has no natural predisposition for the bow, one would stay mediocre no matter how hard one tried. It would be better for such players to choose something easier, like the sword or sorcery. Thierry might have been an excellent archer IRL, or she just had amazing skills. However, the negative aspects of her choice were the reason they could barely move forward now. Why didn't Ross abandon her the way he did the previous odd pair? Was it his fear of getting an arrow in his back? It was a tough question. It could have been that, or awareness that someone else would come to replace Thierry, and they'd be a much less pleasant companion. Walking together was fine, so far, and she had proved her usefulness to boot. Also, she made no overtures after their first exchange, respecting his privacy. Therefore, having a player like her on his side was to his benefit for the meantime. As they would go along together, Ross will pay close attention and try to find out what all those unpleasant characters needed, the ones that seemed to find him effortlessly, regardless of his location, and behaved in a weird manner. They stopped for another short break under a sprawling pear tree growing where two forest paths had met. Ross wasn't tired at all. Instead of resting, he took a walk around their campsite, trying to understand where exactly they were. He didn't have much success. He recognized nothing of the area. There were lots of errors on the maps from the game forum. The ones he could load in the game also lacked precision. Many minor details were lacking from them. He had virtually no data on this area. He had never even gotten close to it. So it was one huge, blank spot. In general, it was clear that they have left the front line behind them, so, in a while, they could turn west and keep on going in that direction until they reached the capital as intended.
"Where do you plan to go next?" asked Thierry all of a sudden.
Ross pointed to the left path. "That way should be best, I think."
"No. We shouldn't go that way, or if we do, we shouldn't go far."
"Why would that be?"
"The ones I'd killed earlier on will be looking for us. They're tarantulas, a very powerful clan. They never forgive something like that."
"Like the clan has nothing better to do than hunt some archer?"
"I've killed their players before. I'm in their blacklist."
"Are you arachnophobic or something? Do you keep killing them all the time?"
"I kill those whose names are written in red lettering. The clan doesn't concern me."
"I get it. Do you collect the stuff PKs drop?"
"I do, but my motivation isn't monetary gain."
"Sure, one doesn't become wealthy by being blacklisted by every clan. I bet it isn't just the tarantulas looking for you."
"Their clan has a special ritual. Sometimes they check just how tough their players are and how well they can solve the problems they may encounter in the game. They send them to some location with lots of newbies, and they have to kill them. Then they have to spend a lot of time washing the blood off their names without the ability to enter any city and risking losing everything in case of death."
So that was her pet peeve. She decided that her role in the game would be to hunt the hunters. Most of those are players who had gotten really disgruntled about being killed without the opportunity of revenge back in their salad days. Some got really annoyed when they're casually disposed of by a character they could not so much as scratch. She had quite a few things in common with Macho Strongman and Nail in the Head, but on the other hand, she was completely different. Those two had no goals whatsoever, except, perhaps, to gorge themselves on good food, whereas Thierry was following certain principles, even if they were somewhat unorthodox. She also didn't give the impression of a silly chatterbox, whereas his earlier companions never shut up. Yet she was strange. He had to give her that. So why is this path particularly dangerous?
"It leads to a large village, and it's kinda awkward to make a detour. Some tarantula's representative will be there for sure. Whenever they do a manhunt, they watch every town and village."
That much sounded logical. No player could exist in a vacuum. They'd have to interact with the inhabitants of the world, and not just the world itself. What would happen if you got hungry, but had no cooking skill or any ingredients to use? Or, say, if you ran out of potions and could no longer level up your character? Alternatively, you could get a serious debuff that wouldn't leave you for longer than an hour and failed to disappear, turning you into a helpless nobody. The solution would be to visit the nearest village and find a vendor or a healer. Then, your problems would all go away. When there was a hunt for Ross, settlements were taken under the control the very first thing. That was the obvious thing to do. No one had enough resources to monitor every forest and every field. "You mean you know where we are?"
"I sure do."
"Have you unlocked cartography?"
"Why would you ask?"
"I have mine unlocked. You could send me the part of your map that has this area on it, and I would reciprocate with the map of some area you haven't been to."
"No point doing it. Just tell me where you want to go, and I'll guide you."
Well, so much for that. Not that it was a pressing matter. So far, Ross was fine with such a guide. He had already come to terms with the oddities of his chance fellow travelers. "Have you had enough rest?"
"I have."
"Are you hungry, by any chance? I have some meat here. It's cold, though. If you manage to shoot something on the way, I can cook something hot."
"Not yet, but thank you for your offer. I will remember it."
She sounded like a talking doll sometimes, completely void of emotion. But you could see something in her eyes, nevertheless. And that something didn't look joyous in the least. It is presumed that a leak of propane was the cause. The explosion resulted in a fire that destroyed 3 apartments. Falling glass fragments hurt several passersby. 2 of them required medical assistance. A number of cars received slight damage as well. One of the residents is in intensive care with inhalation burns, and another was found dead in his apartment. No other deaths or damages have been reported. An interesting detail is that the deceased was discovered in the charred remnants of a virtual reality capsule. Unconfirmed sources identify the victim as Cody Mitchell. Neighbors describe him as a hard-working man who was employed by a major gaming corporation. It is possible that he was involved in some work-related activity at the time of his death. The San Francisco Examiner, San Francisco. Chapter 5. Ross turned the thin strip of meat over, sprinkling some finely chopped aromatic herbs over it, keeping an eye on how the fragments of dry leaves and stalks cooked in the fat exuded by the meat. Going over the top with the spices was never a good idea, but too few would make the meal too bland. Cooking was a lot less mechanical than one might have thought. In order to achieve the best result, one needed to think of every single action. Otherwise, one would get something absolutely revolting and virtually no progress in what was a truly useful stat instead of a tasty meal, disgusting hodgepodge that would even be ignored by a ravenous dog. Theory was nowhere to be found when Ross raised his head. They made their fire at a distance from a neat path that ran through a pristine pine forest with a sandy soil and lots of sunlight. There was nowhere to hide. All the trees were young, and none of them would provide sufficient disguise for a human body. However, a high-level assassin could work wonders. So where could his strange companion have gotten to? Had they been in the real world, he could have presumed she'd gone to look for some privacy in the bushes, but this was a game, so there was no need for it. And she'd have to be really quick to get out of Ross's sight in just a few seconds. He barely managed to put 2 and 2 together after the sudden disappearance of his companion as he heard the sounds of hooves beating the ground. A pair of riders came into sight shortly afterwards. Well, they might have been riders, but their mounts weren't horses. One was riding an enormous moose with oversized antlers, while the other was carried by a creature that resembled a weird hybrid of an ostrich and a bipedal saurian. Nevertheless, Ross had seen riding pets that were a lot more exotic. If one's purse and one's persistence permitted it, one could ride virtually everything. There were plenty of mobs that could be used for transportation. Both riders stopped at once, staring at Ross. He stared at their names in turn, instantly noticing similar clan icons next to their names, tiny black spiders with disproportionately large mandibles. So, the tarantulas were here after all. They stared at Ross without saying anything for a few moments. Then the moose rider asked him, "Are you on your own?" The question was asked politely, and their names weren't in red lettering. Actually, the guys looked okay, but it still wouldn't be politic to tell the truth. Ross nodded. "Yeah, completely on my own. Seen anyone around here?" Had anyone been here, the smell would have attracted them already. Ross pointed at the crispy strip of meat. His interlocutor smiled. "Sure, it smells fine." Ross fibbed. "I'm leveling up my cooking skill here. It's a nice place for it, lots of game, and I've hardly seen any dangerous critters anywhere." "You've been lucky. You can encounter all kinds of critters here. Haven't you heard about the invasion from the Locked Land?" "Everyone's heard of it, but it's way down south, isn't it? Some creatures from the Locked Lands have managed to get far enough to the north. You have them in front of you and on your sides, so you might have an encounter any time." "Really? This is the first time I'm hearing anything of this sort. I must have gotten out of everything over here." "What's the meat? Whom did you kill? And how did you do it? What's your role in the game anyway? Answer." The arrow that hit his interlocutor struck the back of his head, and the arrowhead emerged from his open jaws, ending the conversation. The wounded player hit the ground like a sack of potatoes, while the other one started riding as fast as he could, whipping his ostrich as hard as he could. Theory appeared out of nowhere and approached the player who had been lying on the ground. He was still alive, his horrible wound notwithstanding, and was coming out of shock right about that time. It was the very borderline state when one's limbs are not in one's full control for a moment or two. The bowstring snapped again, and another arrow pierced the player's neck, followed by another one. The player's body grew still at last. Ross barely managed to keep his cool as he removed the meat from the fire, wrapped half of it in a burdock leaf, and offered the food to Theory. She stopped fidgeting around the body of the slain fighter, bit off a piece, and nodded contentedly.
"That's real good. Thanks."
"Anytime.
Ross, we shouldn't keep following this path."
"You wouldn't believe it, but I got to the conclusion that we had nothing to do here on my own. So, what was your reason for doing this?"
"What exactly?"
"This." Ross pointed towards the body that was just beginning to vanish into thin air. "His name was in white lettering, so why would you have to kill him? What was the point?" Theory shrugged him off.
"I'm in their official blacklist. I could kill all of them, and my name wouldn't even become pinkish. They'd just flag me."
Ross shook his head. "That's where you're wrong. Your name is reddish now, and not faintly pink as it was."
"Really? Hey, would you look at this? I got some karma points. So they must have struck me out of their official blacklist. I had no idea."
"Now you can't show yourself to anyone, and you cannot visit so much as a remote hamlet. You shouldn't let anyone see you either." Theory made a dismissive gesture once again.
"I've had my name redder than any Ferrari a few times, but I have somehow managed to survive. Don't you worry."
"Why should I be the one to worry? This ostrich driver will come back any moment with assistance and trackers. It's going to be a lot of fun once they get here. They'll most likely kill you, and your red name may cost you some of your equipment. Was it worth it?"
"They could have killed you any moment, and you wouldn't have managed to reach your destination.
They weren't going to kill me. I would have noticed something like that. They seem to be perfectly decent. Not the kind that's likely to kill you wantonly. And it's you they were looking for. They have no interest in me.
How could I have known that? They tried to screw with you, so I had to do something. Let's get going already. They'll get back soon, surely enough. They'll even splurge on sending a strong party over through a portal, and it's all because of me.
So you've managed to piss them off more than once, I gather?
Oy, you wouldn't believe it.
Theory made a huge understatement about having stepped on a few toes. It seemed as though she had compressed them into absolute flatness, poured hot tar and molten lead over them, and drilled a few holes in them to boot. That was the only explanation Ross had had for the bustle that followed. He'd been hunted with enough persistence himself back in the day, but he'd never seen a wyvern used as an airborne pet before. They were incredibly hard to get hold of, cost a fortune, and didn't live that long. Even the toughest clans valued each one of those beasties, and the fact that one was used for tracking was really impressive. Ross had to revise his opinion of Theory as a result. She must have been a real, low-key murderer to have gotten so popular. She was also a horrible runner, as in, she could run fast enough, but got winded nearly instantly. Her stamina was ridiculously low. Losing a well-organized hunting party with ballast of this sort was unthinkable. Theory was perfectly aware of this. The very next time they had to hide under a tree to evade airborne observation, she told Ross, "Hey, Bubble, we're not going to be able to lose them. Why don't you split? You can run wherever you want to go. They only need me, so they won't be looking for you."
"I wouldn't bet on it. They've seen me, and they know of our association. Just the tracks would tell them as much."
"You're more resilient than me. You can run for much longer. With me tagging along, you'll have no chances. Get going already. Please take these rings. They're my most valuable items. It would really suck if those guys got them. You can give them back later, or not. Still, it would be better if you got them instead of those bastards. Your name is just slightly pinkish. The risk of loss is low. It's still higher than usual. You should know as much. And this place is good for a fight. I'll be able to take quite a few with me."
She was right there. The fir wood was dark and murky, with lots of shrubs. An invisible archer would have plenty of chances to give those in pursuit an unpleasant surprise. But she wouldn't be able to surprise them for long. They'd be well prepared this time.
"Can't you use a teleport scroll to disappear? Have you any idea how much such a scroll costs? I've never so much as touched one. I don't have that kind of money.
I can open a free portal. I have a skill that permits it. You could use it to get away."
"Where to?"
"We'll find a place."
"Will it be far away?"
"Well, the nearest place I can send you to is 2 days' walk away."
"Shall we go together?"
"No, I can't do that."
"In that case, I'd rather get killed. The respawn point is a lot closer. I can't get too far away from you after all."
"Why would that be?"
"Someone asked me to help you."
"Who would that be?"
"Someone whose request I cannot decline."
Damn, she didn't volunteer any information at all. A hard-headed one, for sure.
"Hey, Bubble, why aren't you responding? Get running already. We don't have that much time."
"Be quiet for a moment, will you? I'm trying to think here."
"Think faster. Those guys won't wait."
"Where's your respawn point?"
"What's it to you, anyway? I need to know."
"I made a bind point next to the village we had missed. Do you remember that fork in the road?"
"I do."
"That's where you turn left and go toward the village. There'll be 2 old oaks near the edge of the wood, and my bind point is next to the one that's farther away from the path."
"There's a way of leaving them empty-handed."
"So tell me already.
If you die right now, they'll lose you."
"Well, there's nothing but bunnies and squirrels in this forest. A doe was the biggest animal I've seen so far. How am I supposed to die here? Who could kill me?"
"Well, all you need is the will to accomplish something. I might be able to help."
"You're so low level, it would take you 3 days to kill me."
"I only look nice and harmless. I could actually surprise you."
Well, it doesn't seem too plausible. Trust me.
Okay, what if I do? Are you offering to kill me?
I'm not quite comfortable with what I'm offering, but I'd hate to see them take their revenge on you once they catch you. And I see you cringe at the very thought, too.
Sure. No one would like it to happen to them. They're gonna have a field day today. They'd never managed to catch me before. So they're gonna have all the revenge they want.
Well, you really helped me out back then.